From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. The battle over the GOP's latest Obamacare repeal and replace bill, Senator Lindsey Graham says his bill helps America by taking the federal government out of health care.
So here's the choice for America: socialism or federalism when it comes to your health care.
But President Barack Obama says no, this bill only hurts Americans.
It's certainly frustrating to have to mobilize every couple of months to keep our leaders from inflicting real human suffering on our constituents.
Also today, online learning and massive technological changes were supposed to radically reform American higher education. But the former president of Harvard University says that change has not come. Plus, a major decision handed down today by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. The decision narrows the rules on who can be charged with murder. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today in Iowa, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley held a conference call with local reporters, and in that call he said, quote, "You know, I could maybe give you 10 reasons why this bill shouldn't be considered." He was talking about Graham Cassidy, the latest attempt by Senate Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare. But lest you think that Grassley was saying he's a hard no on the bill, the Des Moines Register reported that he went on to say, quote, "But Republicans campaigned on this so often that you have a responsibility to carry out what you said in the campaign." Well, that was his justification for a health care reform bill that many policy analysts say could be even more damaging than the Senate's last attempt. And that previous bill had a cratering 12% approval rating amongst voters. It did not pass. So what is going on? And why does Graham Cassidy seem to be building momentum towards a vote in less than 10 days? Joining us now to explain is Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She joins us from D.C. Julie, it's great to have you back.
Always nice to be here.
Okay, so last time we talked, I thought that the Senate GOP's efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare had kind of hit a brick wall. So where did Graham Cassidy come from?
Well, we all thought it had kind of hit a brick wall, too. And that's because Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that it was over. And he did say, you know, he pulled the bill. People don't remember this. The bill didn't fail last summer. McConnell pulled it before it was over.
Yeah.
So there was always the possibility that it could come back. And he said afterwards, if there was a bill that could get 50 votes, he would bring it back up. So that promise had been lying out there. And, you know, Senators Graham and Cassidy, and now with the help of Senators Heller from Nevada and Johnson from Wisconsin, have been sort of, you know, doing their due diligence. And nobody gave them, you know, paid very much attention to them until pretty much last week when they went to the majority leader and they said, we're within striking distance. And if you helped give us a push, then maybe we can actually get this through. And so the leadership has indeed been pushing it. And, you know, all of a sudden it looks like they are indeed within striking distance of getting the 50 votes that they would need. But they have this deadline coming up, which is next Saturday at midnight. They would have to get this through the Senate. And if they couldn't, then they would need 60 votes to get something done.
I see. So but if they do it before October 1st, then they can do it with the 50 votes.
That's correct.
Okay.
They're working under a budget process that ends with the fiscal year on September 30th.
Got it. So there were many Republicans or some Republicans who had concerns over, you know, previous versions of repeal and replace because of major cuts that were proposed to Medicaid or Medicaid expansion that happened under the Affordable Care Act. But does Graham Cassidy do anything to allay those concerns? Because I'm seeing that it's making even deeper cuts.
It is making even deeper cuts. This is, you know, this is basically a question of the imperative to get this done, as Senator Grassley was talking about, versus the actuality of what's in it. And, you know, this is more than just repealing the Affordable Care Act, because this also caps the underlying Medicaid program. That was not part of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid. This bill would end that expansion. But this bill would also limit how much states could get from the federal government for Medicaid. So it would make much deeper cuts than just a straight repeal of the Affordable Care Act would.
Okay. So I want the sort of the regular Medicaid part I want to get to with you in just a second. But about the Medicaid expansion portion, I'm seeing here that the Graham Cassidy bill would essentially redistribute the federal money that was once allotted, or currently is allotted to what, the 30 states that opted to expand Medicaid under the Affordable
That's
Care
right.
Act, and they would
mm-hmm.
spread it out. It would spread it out amongst all the 50 states.
It's even more than that. They take all of the sort of benefits from the Affordable Care Act. So there are premium subsidies to help people afford insurance, these cost-sharing reductions that we've been arguing about for the last couple of months that help low- and moderate-income people who have private insurance pay their out-of-pocket costs, their deductibles and copayments, and the Medicaid expansion money. So those three pots of money, they take them, they put them in one great big pot, and then they redistribute them to the states. But what happens is that you've got 20 states that didn't expand Medicaid, so they're not getting that money now. So basically, they've created this formula where those states would get more money and the states that expanded Medicaid would get less money. So, and, you know, in general, not completely, but in general, those are the states, you know, more money would go to states that have two Republican senators and less money would go to states that have two Democratic senators.
Well, and some of those states, I mean, obviously Massachusetts being one of them, could see their Medicaid expansion dollars cut anywhere from 35% to 60%. Now, Julie, I want to play a little bit of tape here because just yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham, you know, while on the one hand railing against what he sees as socialism in the Affordable Care Act, was saying that under Graham Cassidy, things would be more fair for all the 50 states and that any senator who votes against the bill is voting for an unfair system. And here's what he said.
You believe it's okay to help California, New York, Maryland, and Massachusetts more than Missouri. That's just what a Democrat would have to face if they voted no. If you're a Republican and you vote against federalism, you got to explain to people back home why Washington knows better.
Well, so this is interesting because there's maybe a political calculus there, like you were talking about, Julie, because a lot of blue states expanded under Obamacare, but some red states did too. Arizona, North Dakota, these are states that could face some pretty big cuts as well.
And red states can still expand. They can't get the 100% match that was there for the first 3 years, but the match only goes down eventually to 90%. The federal government will pay 90% for the expansion population. In fact, a number of red states have been considering expanding. Alaska was the most recent state to expand. So and then Louisiana, where they got a Democratic governor. But there's nothing to stop those red states that aren't getting this money now from expanding and getting the money.
But then the bill says in 2027, an end to the Medicaid expansion dollars entirely.
Well, it's not just an end to the Medicaid expansion dollars. It's an end to all of the money. It's the premium subsidies and the cost sharing reductions and the Medicaid expansion. That whole big pot of money goes away. And originally, I thought that was because they're doing this under a budget process. You're not allowed to raise the deficit outside the 10-year budget window. But it turns out that's not the case because they keep the taxes, most of the taxes. So they wouldn't be adding to the deficit by leaving it intact. So I'm not quite sure why they end it, but they do. So all of this money goes away after 2026, and then the states are basically left on their own to figure out what to do.
Okay. So that's the Medicaid, part of the Medicaid picture here with Graham Cassidy. What about other things that are currently guaranteed under Obamacare? Pre-existing conditions.
Basically, the way this works is that they give the money to the states and they tell the states, do whatever you want with it. Sort of health. It does have to be healthcare related, but it gives them the ability. And this has been one of the fights all year about whether you can, quote unquote, waive some of these requirements in the Affordable Care Act that people who are sick be charged the same as people who are well, that they have to cover certain benefits, that they can charge old people only three times as much as they can charge young people. Those are the three main ones. Those can all be waived under this. Now, the Senators Cassidy and Graham have been sort of fighting back at people who say that the pre-existing condition protections would go away, saying, well, states would, you know, have to say how they're going to protect people with pre-existing conditions. And that's true. States would have to sort of address that. But that's not the same as saying that states would have to actually do it. States could do it in any number of ways. If you don't have the required benefits, if you waive those, then insurers could offer benefits, but they might not cover everything. So I think there was an example of, you know, somebody with diabetes might end up in a plan that doesn't cover prescription drugs.
Huh. Well, I mean, to that point, I mean, just yesterday, interestingly, Senator Cassidy replied to a tweet from NPR, because NPR had tweeted that people with pre-existing conditions, the bill would remove any guarantee of coverage. And just 2 hours later, Senator Cassidy tweeted back saying, false. Under the bill, states must ensure that individuals with pre-existing conditions have access to adequate and affordable insurance. I mean, is that a distinction without a difference, though, based on what you were just explaining, Julie?
It is. It's just the way it's written. I mean, they've written it in such a way that this issue has to be nodded to, but it doesn't. It's not at all the same as what's in the law now that says that there is a requirement that plans must cover these benefits and that they cannot charge people with pre-existing conditions more. There's even a provision in the bill that somebody unearthed that would effectively let insurance companies raise premiums during the plan year if somebody got sick, not even waiting for the next year.
Well, so since we're mentioning Senator Cassidy here, just yesterday, he was talking about, again, why he thinks his bill is the right way to go for America. And in fact, he related back to his own work with low-income patients in Louisiana. And here's what he said.
It's been my life's work to try and bring health care and coverage to those who do not have. So when a fellow back home named Moon Grafon with a special needs child tells me that he's paying over $40,000 a year in premiums, plus a $5,000 deductible and more money on top of that, we know that the system is failing.
So some common critiques there of the Affordable Care Act. But is there anything in Graham Cassidy, you were talking about this a second ago, but is there anything that would guarantee premiums being held down, stabilization of insurance markets? I'm not seeing it.
No, absolutely. No, basically what the argument is let the states decide. We're going to give the states less money than they're getting now, and they can figure out how to do it. That's effectively what Graham Cassidy does. Now, that's not to suggest that everything is great with the Affordable Care Act. Everything is most certainly not great with the Affordable Care Act. Lots of people are paying more than they can afford. There are big problems, but there was a bipartisan effort to address some of those problems, and it basically got the plug pulled on it yesterday by the leadership, who said it's distracting from this effort to pass this report. You should stop doing this.
So, Julie, suddenly it occurs to me, and this should have occurred to me a long time ago. Maybe there is something to the Republicans' arguments that states can do it better. I mean, I'm sitting right here in Massachusetts. People's Exhibit A of, like, we got almost 100% coverage, but Massachusetts did it on its own with its own version, or, you know, early version of what became Obamacare. So why can't the states do it better?
Well, dirty little secret, Massachusetts had this big cache of federal money that it used.
Oh, the money!
Sorry about that. I was at a conference in Michigan with a bunch of state representatives and a bunch of visitors from Massachusetts, and Michigan was trying to figure out how they could, this was before the Affordable Care Act, but after Massachusetts, and trying to figure out how they did it, and the Massachusetts officials finally kind of looked down and said, well, you know, we had this big pot of money that Senator Kennedy helped us keep, and suddenly all the Michigan officials' sort of faces fell, because it's expensive to cover people with health care. Massachusetts did a very good job, but they also had the money to do it with.
Okay. So, you know, it's interesting because President Barack Obama actually felt the need to speak out about this just today. And he was at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and he was talking about how, you know, he was just feeling frustrated that, in his words, for the 50th or 60th time, again, some embellishment there from the former president, an attempt.
Not much.
Actually, that's true. Attempt to repeal and replace Obamacare. He said he was frustrated, and then he went on to say this.
It frustrates. And it's certainly frustrating to have to mobilize every couple of months to keep our leaders from inflicting real human suffering on our constituents. But, you know, typically, that's how progress is won and how progress is maintained on every issue.
So President Barack Obama there still feeling optimistic at the end. But do we know, there's no CBO score on this. So do we even have any sort of estimate on how Graham Cassidy, if passed, would affect, you know, just overall number of insured, uninsured in America?
Well, judging from what's in it that was in previous iterations, there are estimates that it would be around 32 million people who would probably lose coverage. Hard to know what would happen to premiums because you have no idea what 50 different states are going to do. And there's been an estimate that after 2026, when the block grant ends, that basically the federal government will stop, will have saved $4 trillion, that there will be $4 trillion less in federal money going to the states for health care. It's a lot of money.
A huge amount. So How close is this bill to passing? I mean, where does McCain stand? Where does Murkowski stand? Collins?
It's pretty close. I mean, you know, there are 52 Republicans in the Senate. They need 50, so Mike Pence, vice president, could break the tie. And there are basically four senators that we're looking at who might peel off. And one of those is Rand Paul from Kentucky, who's a very libertarian. And he has insisted that he's a no. Susan Collins, everybody assumes, is a no, although she hasn't said it, but she hasn't voted for any of these plans. And then sort of the two who are on the bubble are Senator John McCain from Arizona, Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. They've both been very coy. They will not say. Senator McCain has continued to say he wants regular order, which would suggest not this process.
This process meaning no hearing or maybe one or two
hearings,
no CBO score.
Well, there'll be one hearing on Monday afternoon and then a half a CBO score, basically. And it's not clear, but he's very close with Lindsey Graham, who's, you know, one of the leaders of this. So no one knows what McCain will do. And Murkowski keeps saying she wants to see how this plays out. So we're just basically waiting to see what these last handful of senators, and if, you know, there's a number of other undecideds. There could be somebody who would pop up later who hasn't been on anybody's radar screen.
It does continue to astonish me, Julie, that this is the process by which Washington is following to make major decisions on a fifth of the U.S. economy.
This is not a normal process. I mean, I keep saying this all year. This is not, you know, for people who are only tuning in now, this is not how Congress typically works.
Well, Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, bringing us up to speed on Graham Cassidy, the latest attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. It is always such a pleasure to speak with you, Julie. Thank you so very much.
You too. You're very welcome.
Listeners, let us know what you think. Massachusetts could stand to lose billions of dollars if this passes, but maybe the GOP is right. Maybe states can do it better. Send me a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. So let's talk for a moment about what could be called the failed promise of American higher education. And I say that because shortly after taking office in 2009, President Obama made his first speech to a joint session of Congress. And in it, he proposed a huge increase in the number of students earning, quote, quality degrees.
We will provide the support necessary for all young Americans to complete college and meet a new goal. By 2020, America will once again have the highest proportion of college graduates in the world. That is a goal we can meet. That's a goal we can meet.
Obama's goal, along with the introduction of new technologies, online learning, things like that, they led educators to predict that higher education was on the edge of major change. However, nearly a decade later, the former president of Harvard University says higher education has not stepped up to the challenge, and in fact, very little change has occurred. He blames the inertia on universities, government officials, and possibly even students themselves. Derek Bok was president of Harvard University from 1971 to 1991, acting president from 2006 to 2007, and he lays out the dilemma faced by colleges today in his new book, The Struggle to Reform Our Colleges, and he joins us now in the studio. President Bok, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. Well, first of all, your book does start off with this challenge that President Obama laid out to the nation in 2009. Did you think it was the right challenge at the time? Did we need to see a lot more young people going to college?
Yes, I think it was certainly a very noble idea, and it had even greater benefits than President Obama spelled out. He was mostly interested in the contribution to a growing economy and a competitive economy you would get if you had many more college graduates. But having college graduates also extends opportunities to a much larger number of people to experience the American dream and live more prosperous, fulfilling lives. It also makes people better off in many ways. They're happier. They are less likely to have substance abuse or commit suicide. They vote more often. They are on welfare less often. They educate their children better. They don't have as much crime and so forth. So there are great benefits outside of the economy that you would get if you were able to meet this goal.
Mm. Now, it's interesting because the president sort of roughly said that the goal was to have 60% of young people between the ages of 25 to 34 having attained a college degree by the year 2020. 2020, I believe. Mm-hmm. And we're not there yet, but there has been some progress. I'm looking at a report from Pew, and it seems like, for example, the total has gone from 41% to 48%. So there's still some way to go. But what do you make of how higher education and American colleges and universities responded to the president's challenge? Did they take it up with enthusiasm?
Yes, there was great enthusiasm from college presidents and college leaders. There was enthusiasm from the business community, I think from the public as a whole. So everything seemed really poised for a major advance.
But it didn't happen, or hasn't fully happened yet.
It hasn't fully happened, no.
And so why? So why?
You mentioned it's gone up, and yes, it's gone up. On the other hand, the percentage had been going up for decades prior to his announcement. So the amount of improvement is not all that great.
Right. I mean, Pew says that more progress would need to be made over the next 4 years than we've made in the past 7 years if the goal is to be reached.
Yes.
And right now the United States is, what, 10th in the world regarding young people 25 to 34 completing college degrees, something like that?
Yes, and that may be on the high side. I mean, most estimates are closer to maybe 11 or 12.
Okay, so then, I mean, your entire book takes up this challenge. But if you could just describe to us in your mind, what are the big roadblocks? What are the challenges keeping us from attaining this goal?
Well, one of them is that it's simply very hard to educate the students who would have to be added to the ranks of college graduates if we were to meet this goal. Most students who have gone to good high schools and have academic aptitude already go to college and graduate. To increase that number by the percentage that President Obama had in mind, you would have to bring in a lot of students who are not well prepared for college, who've gone to financially challenged high schools that exist in troubled neighborhoods with high rates of crime and drug use and single parent families. And we simply do not know enough to educate a lot of those students successfully. And so that's one problem. The second problem was predictably a problem of money. The colleges that would have to educate most of the additional students are community colleges, which receive the smallest amount of funding per student of any segment of higher education. And President Obama offered to propose that they get a modest increase in federal funds. Congress did not go along with that. So you had the toughest students to educate being directed to the most financially challenged schools. And predictably, we haven't made the progress that we hoped.
But in your book, you point out how in times past, for example, after the Second World War, higher education did meet the challenge, right? Because you write how after World War II, if I remember correctly, that basically there was such great demand that the United States was opening one new college somewhere every week.
Sure.
So what's stopping the sort of modern day version of that kind of growth, nimbleness? I don't know what you call it. Response from higher education.
Well, there's an enormous difference between increasing the number and proportion of young people who go to college when only 5% were going to college and getting degrees before World War II. And then you had 4 years of pent-up demand.
Yeah.
And then you had lots and lots of people with a growing economy who saw that a college education would benefit them. And these were students who went to good high schools and had a good education, were pretty well prepared. Very different from the audience that you would have to attract to meet Mr. Obama's goals.
Mm. But one would think that American colleges and universities ostensibly would be the place where we could generate the the best, newest ideas that we might apply quickly to this problem, right? I mean, by definition, the greatest minds should be at these places.
Yes.
But I'm wondering, is there something about modern-day academic bureaucracy that prevents the kind of response that we might want?
Well, I think the real problem has to start with the recognition of how difficult it is. After all, it's not just the colleges. The schools have been wrestling with this problem and making very little progress for the last 40 years. So it is hard, and we simply don't know enough about how to motivate students, who initially don't care that much about education, are not their background doesn't predispose them to be very disciplined in the classroom. Often there are a whole host of problems in reaching them successfully that are very difficult. And they're very difficult whether you're talking about primary school, high school, or the college level. And we are constantly experimenting and trying to find better ways of educating them. But the rate of progress of finding new ideas to tackle this problem is unfortunately slow.
But what about the actual quality of the educations received at colleges and universities? Because you point in the book, or you say in the book, that you don't think students are exerting pressure on universities or adequate pressure on universities to deliver quote-unquote quality education.
I think that's part of the problem, that students are very interested in grades. They talk to their professor much more often about grades than they do about ideas, but they're not so interested in working hard. One of the most disturbing trends that we have, and it goes all the way back to the 1960s, is a 40% drop in the amount of time that students say they devote to their college studies. And if there's one thing we know is that the learning you get out of college is directly proportional to the amount of work that you put in. Now, some very bright students put in less than others, but for everyone, if they do more work, they get more out of it. So that when you lose 40% of study time, and when a lot of that study time is increasingly taken up with multitasking through texting and Facebook and exchanging messages back and forth, that cuts into the quality of the time that they do spend on their studies. So you put all that together, and although, in fairness, we don't have really definitive measures about how much students are learning. We have a lot of bits and pieces of evidence, and they all point in one direction, and that is that, if anything, the quality of education in terms of the amount students learn has probably drifted downward rather than upward in the last 40 years.
Okay. Mr. Bach, forgive me, but I have to say that some of what you say it challenges me a little bit, because I think that a lot of students, a lot of young people would say, well, actually, okay, maybe I spend a little less time in front of my books, but that's because I have to have a job, or I'm looking for an internship, or the nature of how we learn is changing, and it's not correlating it strictly to study time isn't necessarily the best way to measure the quality of the educational experience that someone's receiving.
Well, that's very nice, what you say, but although admitting that the evidence is less than definitive, because we don't have as good measures of student learning as possible, the measures we do have suggest that the amount students are actually learning, however they're spending their time, has gone down. In other words, compared with other countries, we are below average in the performance of students on international tests of verbal literacy, numeracy, problem solving. The few comparisons we have about how much students are learning now compared with a decade or two decades ago all point downward. And certainly employers are complaining a lot about the quality of the college graduates that they're hiring. So There's a good deal of evidence that however the students are spending their time or think they're spending their time, they're not learning as much as we would like.
Interesting. So in the book, you talk about some potential solutions to the challenges faced. And let's spend a little bit of time talking about that. For example, experimental colleges like Western Governors University.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Western Governors University is an entirely online institution. Caters a lot to people who had some college, but not all college. It provides degrees in a few selected, largely vocational subjects. It lets students study at their own pace. It's all done by computer, and they can do it as fast as possible. It gives them credit for skills, not just grades in school, but skills that they've learned in other ways, in the Army or on a job or something. And therefore, it's a much more efficient way of getting them through and to a degree for less money and less time if they're really determined to do it.
Hmm. Well, so on that note, aside from experimental colleges like Western Governors University, do you think there's greater hope in the expansion of online courses? Or was that going to just exacerbate the problems you were talking about earlier?
Well, online colleges, unfortunately, have, if anything, higher dropout rates than going to college. I mean, you get a lot of support to stay in college by the fact that you have friends and you have groups that you're with, and there's a kind of support mechanism there that plus advisors and counselors and human beings who keep you going. You don't have that if you just sit in front of your computer. So it takes a good deal of determination in order to finish. So if you look at these highly publicized and hyped courses we call MOOCs, massive online courses that are delivered by computer, they're marvelous things, and it's a very interesting development. But still, the completion rates are probably under 10%, which is considerably worse than college performance. And there is some indication that poorer students and minority students do worse on online courses than others. So there are some real problems to be overcome before technology offers the solution, we hope.
Well, in the last couple seconds that we had, if there's one reform that you think would be highly effective and could be achievable in the next couple of years in higher ed, what would it be?
I think there are a lot of good ideas circulating around about how to solve these problems of completion and quality. They haven't been tested, which is a great handicap because most good ideas, when you test them rigorously, don't work out in education. I think we need to have a much more vigorous program of research and evaluation, much as you have in medicine or in the space program or many other areas where you have a lot of testing going on, uh-huh. So that new ideas have to go through that and then get into the bloodstream and bring about improvement. If we had something more like that, the rate of progress would be increased.
Yeah. Well, Derek Bok is the former president of Harvard University, president emeritus. His new book is The Struggle to Reform Our Colleges. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Not all my pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So let's take a moment to talk about a 2009 double homicide that occurred in Lowell. Now, we're not going to talk about the shooters in this case. We're going to talk about another defendant. This person supplied the gun and hoodies used in a robbery that went wrong and ended up in that double homicide. That person was then charged with felony murder. Now, remember, he was not present while the actual crime was being committed, but he was charged and convicted. Well, today, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts ruled that felony murder is constitutional and upheld the man's conviction after appeal. But the court did decide to make the rules for future such convictions much more strict by narrowing who can be prosecuted under the felony murder rule. So here now to help us understand what this all means is Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge, retired federal judge, and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Okay, so is this a significant rule from the SJC? Felony murder, constitutional in Massachusetts?
Well, what's significant is felony murder limited in Massachusetts. In other words, the underlying felony murder rule, it held to be constitutional, but limited it dramatically, and frankly, limited it in the way that other states have done in a number of occasions. In other words, limited the circumstances under which it could be applied.
Okay, so tell us more. What are these limitations then that
the
SJC has put
in? Think about it this way. I mean, in felony murder, the usual rule in Massachusetts was if you associated yourself in some way with a felony, robbery, whatever, and death resulted, you are held responsible for first-degree murder, whether you intended the death, whether you sought to prevent it, whether the death was accidental, whether you were present. In other words, one can envision a whole host of situations where someone was really not particularly culpable, but nevertheless was held responsible for the murder. And the reason was all you had to intend to participate in or all you had to associate yourself with was the underlying felony, not anything else. What the court said here is that in order to find someone guilty of murder for participating in a felony, you have to show some association with the desire, with the killing. It can't just be sort of participation in a felony which death results. You have to show he intended to kill or cause grievous bodily harm. He intended to do so. He intended to take an act which everyone knew was going to lead to death or bodily harm.
I feel like, Judge Gertner, in many conversations that you and I have had about a whole number of things outside this realm of felony murder, you always tell me that it's really hard to prove intent. But yet you're saying here that in this case, that's one of the bases upon which the SJC is saying if you can sort of prove some intent, then the felony murder charges is a good one.
Well, it prevents people. When you think of it, there's a range of people who were swept into felony murder, first-degree murder convictions, who had a range of culpability, a whole range of culpability. I'm asleep in the front seat. I have no idea what they're doing. But when they get in the car, they tell me, go. And I know they're doing something wrong. And there's a death that results, and now suddenly you're responsible. Or, as in this case, the guy is at home, in fact, and they take he lends them a gun. At one point, he tells them, I'd rather not. a whole range of culpability, all the way to someone who's actually the lookout standing outside, who fully associates himself with what's going on inside. So you think about a range of culpability, and all that the court is doing here is saying that we're going to limit felony murder to one end of that range, to the most culpable people. That is to say, those people who participated in the felony but intended to kill or cause bodily harm or intended to participate in an event that would lead to where there was a likelihood of bodily harm.
Yeah. So I hear you, Judge Gertner. But, I mean, as you know, Chief Justice Gantz, in fact, wanted to go even further than just narrowing the scope of felony murder. He wanted to completely abandon the rule. He wrote, I also believe that we should abandon the fiction of constructive malice, that where a killing occurs in the commission of a felony, the intent to commit the felony is sufficient alone to establish malice.
Well, that's sort of what he's saying. He's saying if you can't establish participation in the felony doesn't mean you had the state of mind of malice. And in fact, in this case, you're going to have to show something like malice aforethought, something closer to that. People have been hooked on felony murder. It's oftentimes juveniles, actually. There's a whole adolescent issue here. You know, the guy who's asleep in the car doesn't know what the other guys are doing. The guy's asleep on the couch while his friends are doing something else. The situation where you lent something to somebody and you knew they were going to rob it, but you absolutely never intended to have anyone get killed. Where the killing is fortuitous, the killing is accidental. Something happens during the course of it. Those are the kinds of situations which we ordinarily would say would not be murder. The felony murder rule was really an aberration in that universe, abolished in England, abolished in a number of states. So what this court is doing is really aligning itself with you know, what scholars on criminal law and what other states have been doing for some time.
Interesting. So, but there still are other states in the country where a felony murder law is on the books still.
It's true, although actually we were one of the strictest. I mean, other courts have coming up with all sorts of ways of limiting it, not unlike this. Some have abolished it outright. We actually had one of the strictest rules.
Okay. But so how frequently does the SJC do something like this, where they affirmed a conviction but narrowed the scope of the law around which this conviction was created? So
not usual at all. That's what's interesting about this. And in fact, when you read the decision, challenges to the felony murder rule have been going on for years and years and years. I raised a constitutional challenge to felony murder when I was a 29-year-old lawyer. you know, the challenges have been going on precisely because while there may be situations in which it makes sense, right? You shoot someone when you're escaping from a bank robbery. Gee, you participated in the bank robbery, but you also clearly were participating in a murder versus I'm asleep on my couch blocks away. I don't even know what you're doing.
Mm. What does this mean for the conviction of the actual defendant in this case, if the scope of the law itself has been changed?
Interestingly enough, the SJC has authority to review the justice of first-degree murder convictions. And so what they did is they found this first-degree murder conviction unfair, reduced his charge to second-degree murder, which makes him eligible to get out in 15 years, for parole, rather. But they said, going forward, we're changing the standards. Let me just say one other unfairness. It's not unusual for the principals in the robbery, the people who actually participated, to take a plea to second-degree murder. And the guy who was asleep on the couch thinking he can get away with this goes to trial, and he winds up with first-degree murder. So there is a whole host of unfairness that this is attempting to get at.
Hmm. Well, Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hard to believe it, but it is Wednesday. I've been thinking it's Tuesday all day for some reason, Bill. But it is the day that we talk to NPR's the host of Only a Game, Bill Littlefield, and he's with us now to talk sports. Hi there.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks, Magna.
Shall we start off talking about soccer a bit?
Sure.
Okay, so let's talk about the Revolution. They fired Coach Jay Heaps. 5 games left in a not-so-great season. What's going on?
Well, you're being charitable when you say not-so-great. Well, what's going on is Jay Heaps had a couple of quite impressive seasons in which they got a little better every year when he first started as the head coach of the Revolution, and that pattern has been reversed over the last few years. They have not been a playoff team. They're certainly not going to be a playoff team this year. And it's the same in all sports. You can't fire the team, so you fire the coach.
We've been down this road before.
And we'll be down that road lots and lots of times, as long as I keep coming in on Wednesday.
So I want everyone to know that our fantastic producer, Kathleen McNerney, worked on this segment today, and she likes numbers, so I'm going to have a ton of stats for you listeners.
Excellent.
The Revs haven't won in the last 17 games on the road?
No, they've been awful on the road. And I think also, you know, we talk about this as a pattern. They lost a game recently 7-0. And losing 7-0 in soccer is sort of like losing, I don't know, you know, 68-0 in football.
There should be a mercy rule when it gets up
there.
There
really
high.
Should be. And it's it happens from time to time. But of course, Mike Burns, the general manager, has said, no, this is not this decision is not the result of one loss or a couple of games. But it didn't help any.
But there was just 5 games left in the season. Why not wait it out?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they're hoping that, you know, Tom Soane, who comes in to replace him, they'll win 5 in a row and they'll be the Joe Morgan of soccer. You know, he was supposed to be an interim manager for the Red Sox years ago, and they won so many games that he got a couple of years as the as the non-interim manager, and it was great fun.
Well, we've got some reaction here from a member of the Revolution, Chris Tierney. And he says, actually, you know what? It's the players that need to step up.
There's plenty for us to prove. Obviously, it hasn't been a good year, so we as players need to look at ourselves collectively in the mirror and all take into account what we can do better and improve on.
Yeah.
You want my absolutely selfish and utterly unsupportable theory about the why the revolution doesn't
I would take nothing less.
They play on a football field. And they're grandfathered in to be able to play on a football field as long as they want because they were one of the original MLS teams.
Yep.
And all the teams coming in much more recently, there's been a requirement that they have an actual soccer stadium to play in.
But what's, I mean, so in terms of what's different? I've seen
I'm telling you, no, it's not, because it feels like they forgot to tell everybody that there's a game. I mean, even if you get 30,000 people in that building, it looks like it's empty.
Granted.
And the Revs are certainly not getting 30,000 people. They're getting closer to 19,000 people. So my theory, and as I say, it's completely unsupported by any evidence, and it's utterly selfish because I want Mr. Kraft to build a soccer stadium. My theory is they feel like second-class citizens playing in somebody else's house. And it's the obviously it's the Patriots' home. It's a wonderful stadium, I suppose, for watching NFL games because that's how many people go to NFL games. But it's not a great place to watch a soccer game by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, to that point—
So it's not Jay Heap's fault.
Well, he wrote a nice little letter to the Kraft family saying—
He's made his life in soccer, and he hopes, like all people— who are soccer coaches or coaches in other sports who get fired, he hopes to find another job somewhere else.
Well, he said, my greatest regret is not getting you and your family what you deserve, an MLS championship. Mm-hmm. But Bill Littlefield added a coda to that, saying, if you want one, build a soccer stadium.
Build a soccer stadium and they will win.
Okay.
That's my take on it.
Well, since we mentioned the Crafts, this is my chain of thinking, that takes us to football and concussions and head injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday, we spoke about a new study that was released from Boston University about what happens to the brains of people who played tackle football before they were 12 years old. And this isn't even with concussions. These are with subconcussive impacts. And the study found that those folks had greater odds, significantly greater odds, of developing behavioral challenges, emotional regulation challenges later in life. And we talked to Dr. Robert Stern, director of clinical research at Boston University's Chronic Traumatic Encephalopathy Center. He was one of the lead authors on the study, and here's what he said.
Now, correlation does not equal causation. Absolutely not. No matter what, it's really hard to prove causation. And so until we have definitive answers, there's a choice. We either err on the side of safety or we keep going.
And actually, Bill, more specifically, he told us he thinks now parents should have enough information to make the choice to not let their kids play tackle football.
Mm-hmm. And this is not a new thing to consider. Dr. Cantu said some time ago that it wasn't a good idea for kids to be playing tackle football at that age. It's of course there's been some counter arguments, particularly from Pop Warner spokesmen and people like that. And unhappily, the counter argument that I ran up against today was a little bit like the tobacco industry counter argument. You know, the old argument where, well, my grandmother smoked a pack of Camels every day and never got lung cancer. So the argument for the Pop Warner guys is, well, lots of people have played football as kids and gone on to be doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs. And yeah, it's true. And it doesn't in any way refute the results of this study, which says it's really better for you not to get your brain bouncing around in your skull when you're a child.
Mm. Well, I mean, they also did, Pop Warner did take issue with what they called selection bias in the study because it wasn't done face-to-face and perhaps not a 100% representative sample. But really what I want to know, Bill, what your thoughts are on, because I talked to Shira Springer about this yesterday. Like, is youth football kind of on a precipice here? We've got, 1.2 million young people playing youth football. But how many more studies like this can it take before tackle football loses enough kids that it's not the cultural force that it is today?
I think it's a great question, and I wish I had an answer. I think it's probably the case that you'd get a different answer in different parts of the country. In some parts of the country, football is so powerfully ingrained into the culture that it's assumed that young kids, as soon as they are able to strap on a helmet, will play football. And in other parts of the country, parents are more inclined to say, well, my kid has lots of other options. He could play any number of different sports, and I wouldn't feel any compulsion to point him toward one or another.
Yeah. Well, Bill, we've got 30 seconds left, and I just want to ask you one last thing. Let's turn to baseball for a second. Kansas City Royals' Alex Gordon hit the 9,760,437,000th home run the other night. What's the deal?
Well, they've been talking about this since early this season when the home run totals were obviously peaking. And this is what the Guardian had to say about it a while back. Maybe the balls are juiced. Maybe the players are. Maybe no one cares about any of it. The next baseball game you watch will probably have a home run or two or five. Feel free to just enjoy it. And the pitchers say the ball is juiced. Major League Baseball says it isn't. I haven't seen any definitive proof one way or the other, so I guess we enjoy it. Enjoy the dingers.
Bill Littlefield, thanks as always.
Thank you, man.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.